This is Lachlan Rouston.
This is Ralph Friedman. And you're listening to the fittest podcast in Australia,
The Mind Muscle Project. Project, welcome to this round two with Simon Hill from Plant Proof. We were very fortunate enough to get Simon from his busy schedule down in Bondi up to the new studio in Bondi where we got to riff. This time we stayed largely off diet, I would say, and we focused more on planetary health and obviously the impacts that diet have on planetary health, and less, I would say, about the individual health, just more what is the best for the environment, which I think is obviously a relevant subject. We didn't really disagree on anything there. In fact, I think he enlightened us a lot on all this stuff. And then what I thought has been probably one of the best ever, like, just dense structure of information on the podcast is his laying out of the hierarchy of scientific evidence. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, and it relates so much to nutrition, because nutrition is always, you know, amongst these different levels, and it's so hard to pass between them. Oh, like, what, you know, is carnivore, has that got like really good evidence or average evidence? And he laid it out beautifully, which I thought was incredible. And there's stuff I will probably change in my diet on the back of this episode, which I couldn't say the first time.
Yeah. No, this is a great episode. Thank you, Simon, for coming back on. It was a great show. And I think you guys are going to absolutely love this show. And I think everyone's going to get something out of it. It's going to be maybe less polarizing than some of the other guests that we've had on around these subjects. So, guys, today I want to tell you about the benefits that I've been experiencing with the Whoop band during lockdown. Now, if you don't have Whoop, it is the same training technology that Tiger Woods wears, Rory McIlroy, LeBron James, all the best athletes in the world. But I think how it's most effective for people, obviously, it has tons of training benefits, like the recovery score and respiratory rate and all this sort of stuff. But what I liked it the most in lockdown was for tracking my energy burn. So my calories burned each day. Now, the difference between that and a step count is sometimes a step count can be really high, but depending on how many steps you do per day, it's really kind of hard to figure out, okay, how does this affect my diet though? Because we measure diet and we measure food in calories, but if you're measuring activity and steps and working out, it's a hard formula to get right. But the great thing about the Whoop is I have a really accurate calorie expenditure on my wrist. And I will say, there are a lot of calorie tracking apps that existed before and wearables before the Whoop, and they all overestimated. And the reason it's good to overestimate is because it makes you feel good. It makes you feel like you're burning more calories. Well, when in reality, most of us barely burn more than 2,000 to 3,000 calories a day. The body is really efficient. They have done heaps of research on populations that move extremely, like, a lot, and populations that don't move much at all, and their calorie burn is very similar. So Whoops is extremely accurate, and it just allows you to adjust your diet accordingly. So if you guys want to jump on the Whoop band bandwagon with us, and I highly recommend you do, go to whoop.com, use the code MMP15 when you check out. That's MMP15. You get 15% off your entire cart.
And this episode is also brought to you by True Protein. Now, I always talk about the vegan type of protein from True Protein is my favorite.
It's your favorite.
I always go nuts on it. I destroy it every single month. I'm not vegan, but I just truly believe it is the best tasting one. And I like an opportunity to have a bit less dairy in my diet. Now, they have a pea, pumpkin, and brown rice blend, which is the one I have. But they also have a Hasta vegan, which is pea and brown rice. And if you listen to this show, that is the mix-up that Simon uses. And he's obviously very well-versed, and he's jacked as well.
He's big.
Which you find out in an in-person podcast. Yeah. So I couldn't recommend that more highly.
Awesome, guys. Enjoy this episode with Simon from Plant Proof. So, Project, we're back on the show today with one of the most popular guests we had of 2019. Or was the start of this year?
I don't know. I think it was 2019. We just got it in there.
Maybe.
And it was. Yeah. I think it was like right up there in the top three episodes.
It was in the middle of the bushfires.
Yeah. Yeah, so right around the start of the new year, Simon Hill, founder of Plant Proof. And there's obviously a lot to talk about today. I wanted to get into, more towards the end, the hierarchy of evidence that we talked about, because we had some controversial figures after you in this, in a related sense. We had Leah Keith, who was like the, I guess, the anti-vegan, probably.
Vegetarian myth
author. Yeah, and carnivore diet as well. Paul Saladino, who he has a book, I think, as well.
Yeah.
And you've written a book as well, I believe, now, which is awesome.
It's not out.
Oh, it's not out. Okay. But it's finished.
It's finished. It's been pushed back due to COVID and whatnot. So
yeah.
It'll be out. It's going to be out actually early 2021 now.
Oh, cool. So what has changed for you? Obviously, Plant Proof is a digital company largely. So how did your work-life change, and I do want to then get into also planetary health after we kind of get into your stuff.
Yeah, sure. Well, personally for me, I mean, very little changed, in some ways has made me feel guilty because I see, you know, there's been so much damage done throughout the world and so much economical damage and people out of jobs and, you know, out of homes and being uprooted, which is all very sad. And for me, perhaps reflective of the lifestyle that I already live, which is, you know, relatively a recluse of some sorts, I would say.
Work from home, that sort of thing.
You know, I work from home. I spend a lot of time, you know, reading and at home and with my girlfriend and dogs, and we live a fairly simple life in many respects. So, you know, we do have a restaurant. Of course, that was impacted, and that was a difficult situation for us because we have a lot of staff, a lot of casual staff, many that are from overseas and were not eligible for help from the Australian government and have big rent payments in Bondi every week.
Yeah.
And so we had to sort of juggle and try and keep as many staff on as possible and just create work where we could. But in adapting and doing that, we've actually been able to explore some new ideas and new concepts. So some good has come from that.
Yeah, what sort of stuff came out of that?
We had, in December when I last caught up with you guys, we'd started working on a sort of vegan meal prep. One of the things we spoke about was like convenient, like how can you make this food a bit more convenient for people? And we had already had some inquiries from a lot of people saying, hey, it would be really cool if we could just come down and, because the restaurant's in an apartment complex and a lot of the locals come and eat with us regularly. And really enjoy the food, and whilst they're not vegan, they're wanting to add more of this to their lifestyle. So we'd started from December to sort of plan that out. How can we do it? Which was good because we had the wheels in motion.
Yeah,
and you know, so it meant that fortunately, when the closures happened and we had to shut the restaurant, within sort of 7 days we had that up and running. And so a lot of our regular customers were immediately ordering those meals. And you know, from that we've discovered a whole nother side to the business, and that's a whole nother revenue stream. It's created a whole lot more work for the chefs, and for also for the front of house staff who have jumped on, and we've learned that some of our front of house staff are actually really good at marketing, and
right.
So that's been cool. And then from a podcast point of view, I like to do most of my podcasts like this, where we're sitting down together. Yep. And I'd say like 95% of all my previous episodes were in person.
Yeah.
And during this period, I've explored doing some remotely.
Yeah.
Which has meant that I've been able to reach some people that I probably would have never crossed paths with.
Mm.
Just through where they live, and you know, we probably would have never had the opportunity to actually sit down. So it's kind of forced me to do that, and I've had some good conversation. Whilst it still is a bit of a different experience, like you guys have done that, right?
Yeah,
it's a bit of it. It's a little bit different in terms of the flow, because even though you can sort of see that person, it's just a little bit more sort of talking over each other sometimes, and becomes a bit more like a Q&A.
It is, question and answer for sure.
Yeah, yeah. So. But some good conversations have come from that. So, you know, it's been cool. We adapt and we move on.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, one thing that obviously changed a lot was the amount of carbon being emitted from cars and planes in the atmosphere. I don't think it was something that we even recognized at the time until probably, I guess it came on a lot of people's radar when the price of oil became it became more expensive to own oil. And so that was like ridiculous. But what it meant was it was hard to get through all the shit media about the lockdown, all the negative stuff, to find only very brief pockets of, hey, the earth is healing itself. But I didn't look into it enough. I just heard a little bit of that stuff, but I'm sure you would be more around that stuff. I'm curious, what are some of the stats that came out about the earth healing itself during this time?
Yeah, I think, I mean, on the flip side, the bushfires released an enormous amount of carbon.
Yeah.
So, maybe we're making up for some of that. But,
yeah, yeah. It did rain a lot, though.
Yeah, it did rain.
Yeah.
I think more than anything, I think that the what you're talking about, the reduction in sort of pollution and no doubt greenhouse gas emissions, which we can talk about and why that's important, has shown us that what's happening to the climate and to the planet, our host, this planet is hosting us, is being affected by human activity. And for a long time, people were denying that. It was very much, this is a natural course. The heating and the warming of the planet is natural. And if you were to question it, you were seen as a conspiracy theorist. Now that's shifted. And governments now are not saying it's not human inflicted. They're acknowledging, yes, we are warming it. And now it's flipped to, in some countries, they're doing a great job and they're making changes. And in other countries, it's changed from that form of denialism to an economical denial and being very slow and not proactive through the commercial side of things and how it will affect the country's economy.
So they're saying if they lean more towards planetary health and the environment, it's going to be bad for their economy. Is that what they're
correct.
Saying?
Correct. Right. Well, there's various ways of looking at the modeling, but if you look at a country like Australia, right, we are one of the largest exporters of coal.
Yep.
In the world, we're also the second largest exporter of beef. The energy industry and animal agriculture industry are huge emitters of greenhouse gas emissions. So, if there is a discussion to be had there around transitioning and how that will affect the economy, and some people will be pushing for that to happen faster, and some will want that to happen slower.
Mm.
What I think, though, that most of all, and what you're alluding to is, and I think this is really important, is that this experience has shown us that if we all stop and move, do something collectively, we can change the health of the planet, and that's a really good thing for people to see and to feel, because then it may inspire people to actually make changes. Because a lot of the time, we think, well, if I change, what difference is that going to make? But when millions and billions of individuals make change, what happens is what we've seen now. We have to be careful as well, thinking that, okay, let's just go back to normal and not have this conversation because the planet has healed. It hasn't healed.
Yeah.
It's kind of like saying, let's go out and drink alcohol and smash ourselves 3 nights a week for a whole year and then do a 1 week juice cleanse.
Yeah.
Right. That's not going to be the answer.
Yeah.
Although you may learn something from that juice cleanse and you might feel better and go, wow, I feel better than when I was drinking.
Yeah.
So I think the conversation just has to continue on.
Mm.
But what was extraordinary was I felt, everyone always thought if I make these changes, it's going to help future generations. But what was crazy was we did it for a short period and it helped us almost instantly. Mm. They were like, hey, the air is cleaner and you're going to live longer or just be healthier immediately right now.
The canals in Venice were clear, like the smog over Wuhan cleared. Didn't some of the ozone holes heal up as well?
And what they say is, yes, health outcomes go up almost straight away as the air quality improves.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, the particulate matter is what it's called, is, and that's the pollution in the air, is a huge risk factor for cardiovascular disease, which is never spoken about really. It's kind of a little bit underappreciated. But what you're talking about is really important, because when we think of planetary health, I think that we've been slow to react because it's kind of like, who cares? It's going to affect future generations. We're not going to have to deal with this. And if I'm in government now, I need to put policies in place that keep me in government. Mm. And that usually that is ones that puts money in the economy and in people's pockets, right?
Right.
But we have data to show that the changes can happen really quickly, which can improve quality of life now. But we're also the Paris Agreement, which was in 2015, when all countries came together and said, okay, we actually need to arrest this increase in greenhouse gases, because the temperature, if the temperature gets to 1.5 degrees, So 1.5 degrees, which doesn't sound like much.
1.5 degrees more.
Yeah, more than a baseline which was set in the pre-industrial era.
Okay.
Right? So that was before we started, you know, automating everything and using fossil fuels for energy and releasing heaps of emissions. And we'd already started domesticating animals, but this was when we started to really intensify that practice. We were growing lots of people. And I don't think that people in that era, I mean, some people will say that certain people did. I don't think they knew what they were doing to the planet. I think they were just doing what they needed to out of necessity to expand. And they didn't have the data. We can't judge them.
They didn't have computers.
Yeah, they weren't sitting there with the data we have today going, well, geez, wow, in 200-300 years, suckers. I don't think that's what happened. But the 1.5 degrees is important. So that all these, the countries came together and they had this sort of United Nations facilitated meeting, 2015 Paris Agreement. If the planet gets to 1.5 degrees warmer than pre-industrial levels, and at the moment it's at 1.2, some areas of the world, because it doesn't heat evenly, are already at 1.5. If it gets to 1.5, though, as an average temperature around the world, that is when we're going to see catastrophic changes. We're going to see water scarcity, fresh water scarcity, in places that couldn't even fathom it. We'll see food insecurity in countries, in Western developed countries. Right? We'll see further loss of coral reefs. We've already seen what's happened to Australia, but we will lose that. We'll lose biodiversity. Rapid amounts of plants and animal species will just become extinct. This is just at 1.5 degrees, which the target of this agreement is to not get to that by 2030. Okay, but since that agreement in 2015, we've only gone up. We're still heading in the wrong direction. Then by 2050, if we're hitting that sort of 2 degree mark, this is when outright chaos. You can start to have fighting over these resources, food and water. Okay, we've seen what happens in this pandemic when shelves are empty. Our food system is so fragile, though. We think our food system is just there. It's fragile. All of us are weeks away from... If you didn't have food for a week, how would you go?
Right? I'd be very skinny.
Right? Yeah. You'd be very skinny and you'd also... You would do whatever you could to get food. A lot of people would, and that's going to cause a lot of fighting between people.
Yeah.
So this is the reality of 2050, right? So we're going back to what you're saying. Like, I know you're talking about here and now, but 2050 is not that far away. This is stuff that we would experience in our lifetime. This is stuff that our kids would experience, and they would experience it to a much further extent, you know, towards the end of their years. And ultimately, what we're doing is we're creating a planet that's not compatible to our biology, right? It's not going to be able to sustain us. And the planet will still be here. It's humans that won't have a planet. Just like humans right now, if you went to Mars, that atmosphere is not compatible with us, right? You couldn't live there. It's too cold, right? So here, we're doing the same thing. That is, I guess, the really important thing for people to understand at a basic level. We're changing the atmosphere. And as we change that, we're moving further away from compatibility with our own physiology, which
makes sense.
Which is obviously a dangerous thing, and we are in this era now where we've inherited much of this. You know, a lot of this has been set up in systems and processes through hundreds of years. And the bright side, because that all sounds doom and gloom, is we actually do have the data, and we do have humans are very creative. We're very innovative. We can get out of this. We need people to pull together in the right direction.
So when you say our food supply is very fragile, we want to help people understand that. You mean like from the person growing the crops to the transport systems that bring it into the shelves of Woolworths or wherever your supermarket is, somewhere along that chain, it's vulnerable, the whole thing, or is it where it starts to grow? Is it not getting enough fresh water to grow the crops?
So climate changing will affect how much food you can grow.
Yep.
But also the way we're farming now, monocropping and just depleting soil.
Yeah.
Depleting it, right? We've got this system now where it's very macro, and most of the modeling that looks at feeding the world would move to, you would still need some of these big food companies. And that's something we can talk about, because I actually think that they are part of the solution. They get demonized a lot of the big ultra processed food companies, but I think ultimately to feed 11 billion people, they have to be part of the solution. Changes need to happen. But we need some decentralization of farming. And we need to have more security in our food, in our local food systems, as opposed to just these big macro food systems. We need to move away from monocropping and go to polycropping. We need to significantly reduce animal agriculture. And we can go through that too. We can talk about holistic grazing. I think Paul may have spoken about holistic grazing.
Right.
But where I'm getting with all that is we do have the answers to what that system would look like.
Mm.
We need our governments to get on board, and we need people to make whatever change they can make in their day-to-day life, so that all of that adds up, just like we've seen now when people do collectively move in the one direction.
Mm.
And does work from home, does that help the food supply? Cause I think last time we talked about how cities are like one of the worst things possible for it, because I assume we can't just grow locally enough food for Sydney in the area because there's so many people here. But if people don't need to travel into the city and you can just work from anywhere and spread around the country, is it more realistic that you can actually do that?
Well, I think working from home definitely in terms of emissions from driving is a huge one. And I don't want to play down the energy and the fossil fuel side of this, because that is huge. Like, I don't want to just be saying the answer is in animal agriculture. Animal agriculture is a big piece of it. So if you just attacked the fossil fuels and you went green, by 2030, 50% of our overall emissions, this is if you didn't change the food system, 50% of total emissions would be from animal agriculture. So there's huge work to be done in animal agriculture, and most people might be thinking, well, why? Like, why is animal agriculture, why is it so bad? And I think the easiest way to think about it is just looking at it from an efficiency point of view. So if you feed an animal, whether it's soy or grains or whatever. So let's take a cow, for example. You feed it 100 calories.
Is the cow the most common?
Is it
the chicken?
Chicken's the most common.
Okay.
Yep. And chickens are usually fed soy.
Yep.
Right? Which, again, we can sort of go back to how that's grown and what that's doing. That's a big contributor to deforestation.
Yes.
Maybe let's just touch that now, and then we'll come back to to cows. So let's take chickens, for example. They're fed a lot of soy. So 6% of soy ends up being eaten by humans. 70-odd% goes to farmed animals, and the rest goes to make fuel, right? It's actually used to convert into different sort of biofuels.
Okay. Is that a good thing?
Not particularly, because where I'm going with this is that the soy is a huge driver of deforestation.
Okay.
Now, back to this whole 2030 Paris Agreement, right? It's not just go to green energy, reduce animal consumption. We have to protect the forest, because the forests are what hold carbon into the soil.
Yes.
They are what locks it in. When we knock that down, we release carbon immediately into the atmosphere. We lose the capacity to sequester carbon.
Yeah.
And then we start to use it for whether it's growing soy or whether it's even grazing animals. These are carbon emitting practices. Mm. So we've gone from an area of land that was sequestering carbon, holding it, to emitting. You know, and we're just pushing ourselves further away from being able to meet the 2030 goals. So that's soy. And if we go back to livestock, right? So if I talk about livestock, let's look first at grain, like a grain fed animal, which is more the intensive system.
Okay.
If you give 100 calories into that cow, it will produce 3 calories of meat out the other side. That's the inefficiency we're dealing with. Now, where does that go? It goes into living. It goes into growing the bones, the eyes. It's a living, breathing animal. Not everything comes out as meat, right? So we've got this system set up. Right now, if you were to rededicate all of the land, people say, those crops can't be fed to humans. I'm not suggesting, and the modeling isn't suggesting, that you feed these monocrops to all the humans. that land needs to change. It needs to change into polycrop. We need to create these regenerative farms that grow lots of different foods and diverse foods, and they're not just reliant on Monsanto and soy.
Yeah.
So we've got a very inefficient system there. 80% of all agriculture land in the world is used for livestock, but it produces just 17% of total calories. Right. So think about that. 80% of all land, just going back on how important land is to sequester carbon. So it's not just the animals or the methane. It's the fact that we've got all this land tied up that was forest. Not all of it, but a lot of it was forest. And even if it wasn't forest, grasslands by themselves, if just left alone, will hold carbon. Whereas if you have animals grazing, they're still emitting. It's still a net emitting practice. So the bottom line on animal agriculture in every single major report, is that the consumption of these foods needs to drop, and people need to move more towards plant-based diet. When I say plant-based diet, that's not 100%. Plant-based diet covers it even covers the Mediterranean style diet. We're talking about a reduction, a move towards more of a flexitarian style diet for the whole world.
Mm.
So 20% of the land is producing non-animal products, that it's 80% of our diet's calories.
Yeah, so 20%. Yeah, so at the moment, 20%, yeah, exactly, 20% of land is actually dedicated to human calories that go to humans.
And that's 80% of our calories.
And that produces 80% of current calories.
Yeah, right. So why is soy the choice? Like, why was it not something else that we created? Is it because it's the most efficient to grow, calorie dense? Like, what was the choice for soy?
I think it just you're either going to go soy or corn. It depends. So they feed the soy to the chickens. They feed the grains to the cows. Nutrient profile. It's been sold to them as easy just to convert a farm into these monocrops.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been promised, these farmers have been promised to get bigger yields. They're actually getting drops in yields. Their soil quality is degenerating, and that's why I think regenerative agriculture is really important.
Yeah.
Why soy has been chosen, I'm not sure in particular. Probably is from a nutrient profile. It's, you know, being high in protein and rich in certain vitamins and minerals is a good choice for chickens or for pigs.
So if most people want to maintain the protein intake that they have, but they still want a calorie-dense source of protein, and we want to reduce the amount of meat that we're eating or meat that's not farmed in a sustainable way, where do you see as the best options for the majority of people to make up those calories?
Legumes.
Okay.
Definitely.
And how much farming land do they take up?
Very little.
Right.
And the great thing is we can use legumes and have for centuries as green manure. So the...
As what manure?
Green manure.
Okay.
And by the way, I think what will be important is following this conversation, I will do a blog on my website with every single reference that we're speaking about.
Sure.
Because this is not my opinion. This is, and we can come to evidence hierarchy. This is the findings of major reports from, you know, time and time again, huge different independent groups of researchers all coming to the same conclusions.
Yep.
I think legumes are one of the healthiest foods on the planet. The longest living populations all eat legumes regularly, and they are very sustainable. So we need to be growing more of them. We can grow much more of them even here in Australia. And green manure, essentially, we think of manure as sort of putting nutrients back into the soil, right?
Yeah.
And manure does do that, but the manure from a cow, those nutrients, they started as in the soil. They come up through the animal and then go back. It's a cycle, right? And just in the way that they're in the manure, they're also in the plants, and they're in legumes. And you can use legumes as green manure, and lots of farms are doing it. And the great thing about that is you don't have this system in the middle that is emitting a lot of methane. And we haven't gone into sort of different greenhouse gas emissions, but just quickly, the reason why methane is really important is that when we mainly talk about carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, right? And this comes back to that when I talk about increasing by 1.5 degrees, that is due to more of these greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. They trap heat, right? Like if you put a greenhouse in your backyard, right? It traps heat.
It's warm.
It's warm. So carbon dioxide is one of them. It's the one we mainly talk about. And that's generated through the energy industry mainly. And then, and also through deforestation, which we spoke about.
Yep.
Methane is a different greenhouse gas. It is emitted naturally through various sources. And then also the 40% of our methane comes from livestock, the livestock that are grazing across the world. It's from ruminant animals. And the methane is 28 times more potent at trapping heat than carbon dioxide. That's why it's really important. The other important part of methane is that carbon dioxide, when we release carbon into the atmosphere, it stays up there for 100 years. So the carbon that's up there now that we experience is an accumulation of carbon from a long time. There'd be carbon up there from 99 years ago.
Right.
That'll drop out in a year.
But some of it gets reabsorbed
Some of it gets reabsorbed, okay. And we can go through that.
Yeah.
But methane only, there's different sort of estimations, but anywhere from sort of 12 to 30 years in terms of in the atmosphere. So a lot of people say, well, it's not as bad as carbon dioxide because it's not up there as long. Okay. Well, that's true, but it's 28 times more potent at trapping heat. Mm. And also the fact that it's not up there for that long represents a huge opportunity. Because if we want to make big changes by 2030, by 2050, we need to, instead of what we're doing now, the fact that it has a 12 or 30 year, that's really only important if you are slowing down your emissions. If you're increasing your emissions year on year, it's still going up.
Mm.
And that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
So that argument kind of falls to pieces when you look at the chart, the methane just going like that. You just continually, yes, some's dropping out every 12 years, but you're adding more.
Yeah.
So that's methane and where we got there from manure.
Is methane the main cause of methane being released is from ruminant animals?
Yes. So we have natural methane emissions.
Okay.
The main cause is from livestock and from fracking, which is from the energy industry.
Yeah.
And then the third greenhouse gas is, or there is more than three, but the third main one, which together these three are like 99%, is nitrous oxide.
Okay.
And again, that comes from manure.
Okay.
And that's what's responsible for this ocean dead zones. If you read about eutrophication, which happens from runoff of manure into the water systems, and it causes these dead zones, it starts to change the pH of the water and kills the plant and animal species in that area of water. If you Google ocean dead zones, you'll see there are some very, very big ocean dead zones.
So what is an ocean dead zone? Doesn't like allow the cycle of life and the recycling of carbon, that sort of stuff?
Like literally the pH of the water starts to change.
Right.
We've gone through.
We jumped on. I think you were talking about nitrous oxide, or maybe the three main types.
Yeah, so the third one's nitrous oxide.
Comes from manure.
Yeah. So just to sort of round out that conversation around animal agriculture, it's using 80% or so of the land. It's only producing 17% of total calories. It's responsible for a lot of emissions of these greenhouse gases, which is not the only measure of planetary health. The other measures of planetary health are biodiversity, the health of our oceans. So there are many other sort of planetary boundaries that are being affected by animal agriculture. But bottom line is that there needs to be that reduction and move towards more of a flexitarian diet, and a changing of the way that we do animal agriculture.
So if I was to summarize the two main schools that go after greenhouse gases is obviously the fuel that we use, like cars and planes and stuff, which are mostly affecting carbon, which stays in the atmosphere longer, but methane, which is the biggest contributor, is animal agriculture. That's doing 28 times more damage than carbon in terms of, even though it's up there less longer.
Per molecule, yep.
It's trapping heat 28 times more efficiently, basically.
Correct.
And so if we go after the car industry or the motoring industry and Elon gets his way and everyone's electric or whatever, we're going to make a big difference to carbon, but methane's going to be largely unaffected. So we still need to go after animal agriculture. So it's not one or the other, it's both.
And it will take a very long time for the carbon to come down from the atmosphere.
Yeah, but yeah, it will take a lot of time for some of it to come out of the atmosphere. Yeah. But if we, you know, if we also focus on increasing forests and returning land back to forests,
right,
that can help increase the amount that we pull out, which is a big part of the plan. Like it's a very multi-pronged approach. The dietary is one component of a bunch of changes that have to happen. Really,
yeah.
There's a great report called Drawdown 2020. It's probably one of the best reports on this whole topic if anyone wants to read further. And they explain that another significant, really important part of this is education of women in developing countries. And the reason being is that this can sound insensitive, but I'm not trying to be insensitive.
I think Leah talked about this. Yeah,
is that the population growth is actually unsustainable.
Yeah,
and we need to be empowering and educating these women in these developing countries and upskilling them. And in doing that, they will have smaller families.
Yes,
which is, you know, like we have here, we have much smaller families, and that can be a sensitive topic to discuss with people.
Mm.
But I mean, all of these are uneasy topics to table. We're in this position and we kind of have to be able to have these conversations.
Yeah, yeah, I don't think it's that insensitive. I mean, it's pretty factual, right? Yeah. If women have lower education, generally what they're told to do is sit at home and just make babies. And they're not, you know, put into society to produce goods and to, you know, active services or whatever. They're just like, okay, all you are is a baby maker. You're not good for anything else. And so, yeah. Educating women that they can do more than these things. They're equal. All humans are equal. They can produce in the same way men can. It's simple. It's just it will help the planet
equally. So yeah, the less of us, the better.
But in Western countries, population growth has flatlined as well, which is great, and that's largely to do with education.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if you, in the modeling, and the reason why this sort of 11 billion population gets thrown around is because they think that once we hit 11 billion, it will flatline, because that will be when the developing countries are sort of more in a position like us, and it does come to a halt. So it's just, all it is about now is working out, changing systems and working together to get to a position to be able to sustain that many people on a planet that has finite resources.
Mm. So I think if people were to take something away from this and really contribute to this whole goal, if they're walking more and they're catching less, they're using their cars less, or maybe catching more public transport or whatever, and they're also reducing their meat consumption, it's like a double whammy.
Absolutely.
You're going at it from both ways. It doesn't have to be one or the other. Yeah.
And I mean, we haven't really spoken about this, but this is probably something that's good to add, is there, it's just being careful of what is called greenwashing. Have you heard of greenwashing?
No.
So greenwashing is when something is kind of put up as a solution to an environmental problem, but it's not really. It kind of looks good on the surface. And this, the first one is a bad example. It can distract us from the bigger picture at sometimes, right? Okay. So like
oversimplification,
single-use plastic, right? Or let's say straws. That, of course, incredibly important. I don't think people should use single-use straws, but it became such a huge conversation.
Mm.
90% of plastic in the ocean is from fishing. It's from fishing and the byproducts of all the fishing nets and all the fishing gear
that gets left out in the ocean.
90% of the plastic. So we have this big conversation around straws, which I think is really important, but we have to be careful not to be distracted from what might be more important. And one thing that comes to mind there is this idea of, we're talking about regenerative agriculture. Now, I'm all for regenerative agriculture, and within that is holistic grazing. And you may have come across this, right? So holistic grazing, which is better than standard grazing, it's definitely better than intensive feedlots.
Yeah.
The only one good thing about intensive feedlots is that they produce less greenhouse gas emissions, and that's because they grow the animals so quick.
Less than normal, just go eat grass and be a normal cow.
Animal producing methane, he lives like two and a half times longer.
Okay.
Right. So there is a certain segment of people out there on it from a sustainability saying, let's just move more to intensive.
Okay.
It's not the answer. It's still producing emissions. It's still responsible for all that deforestation of all that soy. That's kind of just, you know, would be choosing which
evil,
out of the two. But there's this sort of movement around holistic grazing, and there's a guy called Alan Savory. I'm not sure if you've watched his YouTube videos.
Nah.
So his YouTube videos essentially went viral, where he speaks about he uses the word climate solution in his title,
mm-hmm.
and he talks about a specific way of rotating livestock over land, and in doing that in this very specific way, you will sequester carbon and pull it out of the atmosphere.
This guy a farmer?
This guy's a rancher, yeah.
Okay.
So it's a net positive. You're like growing food to eat.
Correct.
And net positive on the environment.
Well, yeah, exactly. So that's what the claim is that is being made or was being made. And it did go viral. And I've got to admit, I watched that video 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately when I watched it, I thought, if this is real, I've got to change my opinion on this. This is a legitimate solution. Mm-hmm. Because when you watch it and he talks about, it's very compelling. Here's the problem. When you do holistic grazing, you definitely improve the soil quality. 100%. 100%. You improve the soil quality. However, there's a huge report out there called the FCRN, Grazed and Confused Report by Oxford University. And this looks at every single peer-reviewed study out there that looks at rotational grazing. And all of the peer-reviewed science shows that even when you use rotational grazing, it is still a net emitting practice. That is, even with some carbon being pulled in, when you factor in the amount of methane and nitrous oxide that's coming through having those animals, it is still producing 40 to 60%. It's still a 40 to 60% net emitting practice, right? So there is some offset to the methane, but it's still a emitting practice, which means it's not a climate solution when we're in a position now where we need to reverse our emissions, right?
Right.
So it is better than grazing, and it is better than intensive, but it shouldn't be marketed to people as a climate solution. For me, that's a little bit greenwashing, and it's
right.
You know, it's kind of just extended it a little bit further than what it really offers.
So if the intensive farming is say like 100 points of gases, that would be 40 to 60 points of gases being emitted, or is it significantly less than intensive farming?
What it's saying is it's not significantly less than intensive.
Okay, so it's still pretty close.
Because intensive is arguably even still better. I'm comparing it to normal grazing.
Oh, okay.
But what it's saying is that of the total emissions that the animal is essentially emitting, only about 40 to 60% of those would be offset through the carbon, which means there still is a net amount of total greenhouse gases being emitted.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And, you know, more to the point is this requires a lot of land. Again, the intensive system is good at producing a lot of meat. So if we moved to that model, let's just say, okay, we say, okay, it is better. It's a step in the right direction. It's not a climate solution, but it's a step in the right direction. There is not enough land to produce meat that way to feed the whole world based on current meat consumption. So we end up back at this position of reducing your meat consumption, no matter which way you sort of dice that.
Mm. So what if you found a way to, because I know some of the stuff they're doing, they're trying to grow cultures in a lab, right?
Yep.
Now, let's just say we were able to produce like soy cultures in a lab. I don't know if this is possible. I'm just theorizing right now. If there was a way to feed animals in feedlots, let's just say from the options we've got right now, feedlots are the most healthy for the planet, I guess. And if we could feed them without all the farmland that came along with it, like all the soy crop and all the grain crop and all that sort of stuff, would it be a good thing in the short term in the next 15, 20 years?
I mean, that would be huge.
Right.
And like cellular agriculture, the creation of meat in these laboratories, it sounds really crazy, right? It sounds far-fetched. Mm. And there are probably now 50 companies around the world working aggressively on getting this to the market. Yeah. And in the next 5 years, you'll see it. A new documentary just came out on it. And I'm for that, because from an environmental point of view, that is going to be huge.
Yeah.
Because let's face it, there are going to still be people out there that want to experience the taste and flavor of meat. They're not going to change that habit.
Yeah.
But cellular agriculture, essentially, if people are not aware of it, and it does sound weird when you first hear this, is using stem cells and essentially being able to grow meat in a factory.
Yeah.
And
so no animal ever lives.
No animal. Yep. And why that's important is, back to the start, we spoke about, you put 100 calories in, the animal has to live, it's got to grow its brain, its eyes, all this stuff that just goes to waste.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it's emitting methane. Now, if you can completely change that system, then that's huge.
Yeah.
You can produce all this meat with no methane. You're not using all that land for the calories. So I think that's going to be a huge evolving space.
Yeah.
Because
that was my first thought. If we can grow that meat for humans, but they're still going to want to eat normal meat, why don't we just grow the food for animals as well? Because they're going to be way less fussy on what they eat, you know what I mean? Like, if we just feed them nutrient-dense calories or whatever, and it doesn't cost us land and doesn't cost us emissions, then that would be a great solution. I'm sure someone's obviously working on that as well.
Yeah, I mean, you still, in that scenario where you're saying you do that with the soy, you would still, the animal would still be emitting methane.
Of course,
So it would, granted, that would definitely be a huge step in the right direction, because that would mean you don't have to keep cutting down the Amazon.
Yeah.
And in Australia, the number one, and this is something that I didn't know this, the number one driver of deforestation in our country is animal agriculture. And we think that our land is just arid and it just exists for the grazing. The number one cause of deforestation is animal agriculture, creating
animals.
More land, right? Because we are expanding the industry and we are exporting huge amounts. And also, we are the number one country in the world per capita consumption of red meat.
Mm. Oh. And for drugs.
Yeah.
People didn't know.
Yeah.
We do. So we tick a box in a lot of those
red
areas.
Meat, and you know what the other one is?
It's a good time in Australia.
Greenhouse gas emissions per capita.
There you go.
We're the number one. And the argument for this is that...
We are so gangster.
The argument against that is, we only have 20 million people, so the absolute amount is not that big,
right?
So the absolute amount of Australia's emissions is only 3%, about 3%, 3% or 2%. Don't quote me on that. So it's around that, right?
Of the total global emissions.
It's very small. The problem with that rationale is, how can we expect developing countries to make changes when we're setting terrible example, and they are almost aspiring to our lifestyle?
Yeah.
You know, they want the meat because it's seen as a
delicacy
and status.
Yeah, 100%.
And we've set this example of huge meat consumption. We haven't shifted to green energy fast enough. And a lot of that, again, goes back to the whole economical thing.
Mm.
Why shift to green energy here locally while we're exporting the most amount of coal?
Yeah.
It's a little bit hypocritical. There are various things at play. All of that stuff can start to get highly complex, but if we just break it down and bring it back to a per-person level, I wrote a blog on the flexitarian diet, even just like a shift to a flexitarian diet, which is two plant-based meals a day and one meal with animal products, a shift to that diet across the whole world dramatically improves planetary health.
Mm. And then you obviously included in this is the dairy industry as well, right? This is all part tied into the animal agriculture stuff as well, right?
Yeah. So dairy, dairy and red meat from a planetary health point of view are the two worst.
Okay.
As you move down, like chickens is much more efficient and a much lower environmental footprint than those two industries.
So what's your, because I think whey protein is obviously the most consumed protein powder.
Mm.
What's the next best? Whey obviously has tons of amino acids and it's a very complete profile and it's great. What is second best to whey?
From a plant-based point of view?
Yes. Yeah.
I personally do a pea and rice blend.
Okay.
And that delivers a pretty good amino acid profile because one's lower in leucine and one's lower in lysine. Makes a pretty good profile there. And, you know, soy is better, but I don't like having soy in an isolated form.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm going to have soy, it's going to be in tempeh or edamame most of the time.
Yeah, I know, because one of the things that I thought that was like a really good switch for a lot of people, and I think a lot of people are switching to the vegan choices because they're becoming more tasty. But one thing that came up was this massive study that went out. They started auditing all the American protein powder companies, and it was like 95% of the protein powders they tested were had heavy metals in them, in the vegan choices. Yeah,
I mean, we have heavy metals for our entire food supply.
Right.
If we were testing animal products and whatnot, we'd also be shocked what's in those.
Right.
So I think I saw that study as well, and I think that's just reflective of our total food system. Definitely, if you were to test a lot of the fish that people are eating, it's there are pollutants and chemicals in our system. I would say though, when you are buying a protein powder like that, you whatever company it's from, whether it is the whey protein or whether it is a plant-based protein, you should be vetting that company and asking for documentation, because they do run their own tests.
Yeah.
And finding one that is low in contaminants.
Yeah. Yeah, it's important. Okay, so we wanted to get to the hierarchy of evidence. Now, the reason being, I think it came up, it was important, is because the guest we had on, Leah Keith, she, you know, after we had her on the show, you know, we let her say her piece. Mm. You came back and you said, hey, look, you know, some stuff she said in there was just like, you know, the sources aren't very good. And we didn't really check the sources outside of what was in her book. But a lot of it that came through was a big mix of different things.
Yeah.
There were some studies, there were some articles, there were some opinion pieces, some videos, whatever. Now, I think people are becoming more scientifically literate, but also illiterate at the same time. They can't distinguish between different types of studies. Definitely. And what's legit, what's not legit. So, you spend a lot of time in the research. Yeah. And you're studying as well. At university, and so you kind of have an academic side to you as well that you understand. So help people kind of understand the different types of studies when they're reading them, so they can help kind of decipher them themselves.
Sure. Firstly, I think it's good to get people on the show with different ideas and different opinions.
That's why we do it.
But I do think it's getting harder and harder for the listener to sort of work out how equivalent is that information.
Yes.
Right, and there's a thing, you can have false equivalence where one person is presenting anecdote and someone else is presenting scientific evidence of a very high quality, but it appears like they're equal, and it's like, sure, which side?
Yeah.
So there is a thing called the evidence hierarchy, and think about it as like a peak on a mountain or a pyramid, and down the bottom, the very bottom, is like the lowest form of evidence.
Mm.
And what this hierarchy, before I go through it, what this does is it allows us to actually look at evidence and compare evidence and work out, well, which is a stronger form of evidence, so we can come to a conclusion and make very science evidence-based decisions. And that's why earlier I made a point that I'll put all of the references that I'm talking about into a blog, because it's not just opinion. So I finished my master's in nutrition now, right? That people would say, okay, well, he's an expert in nutrition. Now, that is opinion. So expert opinion, let's say expert opinion, let's start with that as a form of evidence. So for me, just to say something.
Is this at the bottom of the pyramid?
Yeah, the bottom of the pyramid. Okay. So the bottom of the pyramid, the least authoritative sort of credible level of evidence is expert opinion with case studies. Case studies is like an N equals one.
Yeah.
Type of stuff.
Yeah, I tried this might as well. Yeah.
And a case study, I should say, is a bit more than an anecdote, in that it is sort of formally documented and can be published into a journal or whatever, but it's still like a one person type of thing. So that's expert opinion and case study. And we'll come back to that. Then as you move up the pyramid, the next layer is laboratory studies. So this is where we look at mechanistic style things, and it could be studies on animals, or it could be sort of in vitro studies using human tissues and cells and looking, you know, petri dish size. So imagine zooming right in, what happens in a petri dish now, and then understanding the reason why that is sort of towards the bottom is that not everything that you see that happens in a petri dish happens when you expand out into real life. So the next step above that is observational epidemiology. And within that, without boring the listeners, there are different types of epidemiology, but essentially epidemiology is going out and looking at real life populations of people and looking at whether it's disease prevalence or looking at how people eat and then monitoring them over time, which is like a prospective, or you could do a retrospective study and just looking at what happens in real life. And in that, you're trying to control for various variables, other variables. So if you're wanting to look at just the effect of diet on an outcome, then you want to what's called control for alcohol and exercise to make sure that those things aren't affecting your results, okay? Because if group A and group B eat differently, but they also exercise differently and they also have different alcohol consumption, it's hard to work out where's the finding.
Yeah.
So there's a statistical process called a multivariate analysis, and that allows you to control for variables. Not perfect, but still, you can look at populations with hundreds of thousands of people, and we can start to get what's called correlation. And that is associations that exist. They're not always going to be correct, but what we're looking for with all of this is things pointing in the same way, same direction. The mechanistic study pointing somewhere, the epidemiology also pointing there, and then the next level above epidemiology is clinical intervention trials. And this includes randomized controlled trials, which are the highest form of a clinical intervention. The subset of that being what we call a metabolic ward study, which is where you actually bring subjects into a hospital setting and you perform your randomized controlled trial in a hospital setting. So they're not going out and home and eating whatever.
Yeah.
You're literally watching every single thing they eat. If we're talking about a randomized controlled trial on nutrition. And there was a really interesting one that just came out. We can talk about that after on the ketogenic diet.
Okay.
So that's randomized controlled trial. And everything that I've sort of discussed there from the animal study to the epidemiology to the randomized controlled trials is what we call primary research. That's you guys going out, Raf, Lock, going out and performing a study, and you're the investigators and you're actually watching it and you're dealing with the people. Then above that is secondary research. So secondary research is when we take information from whether it's randomized controlled trials or epidemiology usually, that have studies that have looked at the same thing, the same relationship.
Yep.
And we take heaps of them and we combine them, right, to try and remove bias. You know, so if we, instead of looking at just one study that's looking at the consumption of apples and cholesterol, we look at 40.
Yeah.
Okay. So then, you know, maybe there are a few different results in there, but when we aggregate and look at the overall outcome, what was the relationship between a study that was in Japan, a study that was here, all over the world?
Yeah.
Different researchers.
Yeah.
And that is considered. And that's a systematic review and meta-analysis. And that is considered the sort of gold standard of science.
Mm.
So what happens is if you sort of come to me and you show me an animal study and you say, look, I can show you that if you consume an apple, it turns off this cancer cell, right? But if... So that's interesting. That's really interesting and worth investigating. But if the research above that, if at the randomized controlled trial level, you know, they did big studies and randomized people and gave people apples and that didn't play out, then that's a higher form of evidence.
Yeah.
So you can't sort of just run away with the mechanism study because it suits your narrative.
Mm.
It was interesting and it sort of generated a hypothesis, but it didn't play out in the more sort of rigorous form of science.
Yeah.
So that whole thing is a science is an evidence hierarchy, and anything that I look at, I go through that lens.
Mm.
So if someone, I get a lot of, you know, here and there, I'll get trolls, and they'll comment something, right? About they'll say fiber's bad for you, right? Okay. Well, I can show meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials showing fiber is good for you, which is automatically the gold standard, right?
Yeah.
But I can also show randomized controlled trials, I can show epidemiology, and I can show mechanistic studies, you know, all showing that relationship. And So I go back and say, well, what evidence can you show me? And that's how a scientific conversation really should start. And it should have two people not attached. Their opinion shouldn't be attached to their ego. It should be about the truth of, okay, I've formed an opinion based on this science, but I'm open to changing it. I'm open to up level and up, you know, change my view if you can present science that's better quality.
Absolutely.
So that's my approach with everything. Now, after the reason why I sort of got in contact with you after, particularly after and again, this is not a personal attack or anything like that, because I want to talk to the science that was presented, and again, back to false equivalence. So, when we are talking about science, we're referencing and talking about things, we in good faith, we really should be talking about high quality science. If you look through that book, there are references to Wikipedia. There are references, and another really effective trick to do is to reference other authors. So again, that's expert opinion. That's down the bottom. So you can write a book and say whatever you want, but then that creates distance for the reader to get to the source of where that science was, and makes it almost impossible for them to sort of work out the truthfulness of these statements. They'd have to go on a rabbit hunt and start digging through all these other authors' books. Which is like in the book I've just written, where there's about 950 references, I'd say 75% are meta-analysis, systematic reviews and meta-analysis. I reference to one other book, and there's no Wikipedia or things like that. This is all science. So every single statement that's in there, someone could go and look at that reference, and it is a clinical study. But I mean, just broadly speaking, so that's the evidence hierarchy. And then outside of that, which isn't even in the evidence, is anecdote, YouTube video, Karen from Facebook, Kevin on YouTube,
a lot of those,
you know, that sort of stuff. Where it's not even an expert opinion, it's not even a properly documented case study. These are very invalid. Like, there's no way of validating what these people have done, you know. So if someone has like this example where we're talking about, had a problem on a vegetarian diet, we have no way of validating what that diet was like, what was the quality of diet. We have so much data to suggest the contrary, and it becomes false equivalence when you take huge studies, huge meta-analysis against a one person anecdote. And then that becomes very confusing for the listener, because the listener seems to think, oh, okay, maybe there is some truth in this, and maybe I shouldn't adopt that lifestyle.
Yeah.
So I just want to just get some clarity, I guess, around where the science sits on that. And I mean, I don't know if you want to sort of explore specific things about nutrients or whatnot.
No, I think what you did there was beautiful, and I don't think anyone's ever explained it as well as you just did. And I think it's really important for people to understand and take this into their own lives, because, you know, there's a really good example in a book that you and I just finished reading about, the power of how much anecdote can affect us emotionally as human beings, which is why when you present someone with all this great scientific evidence, they will ignore it in the face of the one person they know that had a bad experience. So the example they give in this book is, this guy goes to buy a car. Is this a car that he really wants, right? Let's just say it's a Toyota, right? This Land Cruiser. And it's a car that you know he wanted. And I've searched through 4,000 different reviews, and it's a 5-star car. There's nothing wrong with it. There's like a couple of, you know, 1 stars here and there, but the vast majority of the evidence is showing from a much bigger data pool that this is a great car. So the guy goes in to buy the car, and on the way in to purchasing the car, another person comes out, and he's furious. He's pissed off. He throws the keys on the ground. He goes, the Land Cruiser is the biggest piece of shit. It broke down the first day I got here. This is absolute crap. I would never buy one. If you're going in to buy a Land Cruiser, don't. You're going to have the worst experience ever. It's one anecdote versus 4,000 reviews that the majority of them are 5 stars. But because you've had that personal experience, you've had the emotions involved, you've seen this person in the flesh, you know their story, it might make you think second about buying the Land Cruiser, but it's not, it's one person, it's one anecdote. And I think it's just important for people to understand that how powerful anecdote is, how much it can affect us, but you need to overcome that and look at all the stuff you're saying, look at the real evidence that's there, and really trust in that. And this is the problem now with, you know, relating it back to the virus, is that, you know, we're getting obviously, okay, let's just, a lot of the data, there's a lot of controversy on how the data is collected and what it says or whatever, but just putting that stuff aside, a lot of people, there's so many arguments against the massive data from one or two pieces of anecdote. Oh, well, you know, this guy got it and he was fine. Or like, yeah, this person got it and they were young and they died, you know? And it's just like, well, okay, that's such an isolated incidence. We can't compare it to all this major stuff happening. We can't have people say, yeah, but you know, 5G is causing the virus. It's like, well, okay, but there's 5G everywhere. And, you know, sorry, there's 5G is not in that many places, but the virus is everywhere. So like, how does that make any sense? And the person that is making up those theories is also the same person that isn't a scientist, and they're selling you fucking lead paint to paint your walls in 5G, and they're profiting off you believing that stuff. It's like, how valid is them? If you went and met them, you'd probably think they're a nut job. So I think there's just like, it's so important right now because it's so relevant for people to understand what you just explained.
Yeah. And you, the key word there that I liked was like critical. You have to critically think about things.
Yeah.
And you have to question it. And anecdotes are interesting, and that we gravitate towards them because of that fact. Like, it is interesting to hear someone's story. We love stories.
Yes.
But we just need to understand that, you know, in terms of the overall being a level of evidence, that they're usually invalid, they're not credible, and we shouldn't be basing public health recommendations or the recommendations for us and our family off of them.
Mm. Yeah, it's a very interesting time. So last time we had you on, you know, we answered the four questions and stuff, and I don't know how much these things change. I know you spoke to some people that, you know, I think are really interesting. You spoke to the guy, the author of Lifespan. His name's
David Sinclair.
David Sinclair.
You guys need to get him on.
Yeah. Well, one of our good friends works for him, so okay. It should hopefully happen soon. But yeah, with all the podcasts that you did overseas and some of the new ones you've been doing, is there anyone else now that you feel like, because you have this expanded reach with not having to do them in person, that you really look forward to interviewing or want to interview?
Well, one that I did interview, David Quammen. I'm not sure if you heard of him. Oh. So he's a National Geographic science writer. He's done some really cool stuff. Like he's done explorations through the Congo, traveling with virologists, studying, you know, different zoonotic diseases, these infectious diseases for decades. And so I had sat down with a remote conversation with him. And he sort of just explained the origin of viruses, and again, this ties back to the planetary health conversation, because what I found fascinating about that was a big contributor to the zoonotic diseases, and the fact that this was predicted and many more are predicted.
That's diseases that jump from animal to human.
Yep. Yeah. So these diseases exist already. There's arguably millions of them that we don't even know about in reservoir hosts, and the reservoir host could be like a bat or you know, another animal. Yep. I think this one they said maybe pangolin or a bat, and the immediate thing is people think, well, why don't we just get rid of the bats? But the issue is our relationship with nature. We're encroaching on them, we're ripping down forests, and there's actually what was really interesting. There's a virus that came out of an area in Queensland. I've forgotten the name. It starts with an H. Came out of Queensland, and how this virus, this was, I think it was about 20 years ago or so, 15 years ago. It jumped from a bat into a horse, and from horse to human. Now, it wasn't that contagious, but it was very, very deadly. So it actually killed people. And the reason why they think that happened was because of deforestation, and the bats were moving closer to where the horses were kept, and you were bringing these animals closer together, and through the bat's urine, you know, the animal eating the grass, that's how it was transmitted to the horse, and then from the horse to the human. But that was a really fascinating sort of episode, just to understand how these diseases exist and jump from animal to animal and to animal to human, and you know, how it ties into that planetary health conversation.
Yeah, I definitely think it's all part of the natural population control that the Earth has. If you start fucking with it too much, it goes, hey, well, these things that weren't supposed to mix and these things that weren't supposed to be in this bigger number, because we had natural mechanisms in place that you, with these crazy humans with these huge brains, have managed to override, I'm going to send you like this thing that is going to just completely knock your socks off. In this case, it was the coronavirus. You know, in Australia, it was the bushfires. Like, all these things, I feel like, are the natural population control. So, yeah, there's obviously heaps of ways to go about it, but I don't think it was this like crazy thing grown in a lab that was like released into the population as a conspiracy. Like, okay, even if it is, whatever, the same thing that happens, these viruses came about and they exist because they are trying to control the natural balance of life.
Yeah. And, you know, many people predicted this, like in many books, in his book, his book called Spillover, he literally predicts that the next virus will most likely come from a bat, because they know that many of them exist in bats. And it's kind of just inevitable with the way that with our lifestyles and moving, closer to these animals.
Yeah, and Gates predicted it on that TED Talk as well. Yeah. Anyone that knows anything about viruses and is in that sort of disease prevention world, they also
come. Well, that's part of the conspiracy now. Because,
well, what's the conspiracy? I love that. The fact that
he predicted it
means he caused it.
Yeah,
yeah.
To increase his TED Talk views,
apparently.
Yeah, man. If people just the fact, I think that. The best part about Bill Gates is that he's so good at doing what he does, and he's like potentially one of the most impactful, most important human beings of all time, that like it only makes sense that he has like 5 million people that like think he's the devil.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, all right, well, it makes sense. Yeah. But he has no time for them. He has no time for them. So
yeah.
That's good on him. So, well, second question we always ask is a routine-based question. Is anything, have you adopted anything new? I think it's always fascinating that maybe the lockdown made you change. I know a lot of things didn't change for you, but maybe a different perspective. Like, hey, I'm going to do less of this now or more of this. Did anything from that perspective change for you?
Not really, to be honest. Okay. Routine stayed the same. A lot of time spent with my dogs, a lot of riding, probably a little bit more riding, actually. It was almost a blessing in disguise in terms of being able to, I don't know about you guys, but riding and being able to focus on one thing these days is getting increasingly harder and harder.
Yeah.
So I think maybe that was it. Maybe it was just a decision to sort of try and hyper focus in on that and use the time as productive as possible.
Yeah, I think it's the entrepreneur's dilemma is that you have your own schedule. So like if you're not careful with it, you can just spend 10 hours a day on Instagram, right? So it's like you have to be disciplined in having this single focus on tasks. It's actually a really good book. I don't know if you know Dan Kennedy. He's like a marketer.
Yeah.
And his book is, it's the No BS Time.
They're all No BS.
Yeah, the time. It's time management for entrepreneurs. Yeah. And it's like one of the best books on time management you could ever read. And it's just good because it's coming from, he's a writer as well. But he's also like a multi-millionaire. Like, what do you reckon he's worth? Maybe like 100, 200 million US dollars at least. Yeah. And he works with all kinds of entrepreneurs that are billionaires and stuff as well. So it's kind of like, you're taking advice from someone who's like, in theory, like one of the busiest people in the world and works with the busiest people in the world and sees that it works. Because it's great to have like time tips from, you know, Sally the blogger or whatever, but she doesn't have that much going on. Like she's not that important.
Yeah, so, you need someone who's sort of living your lifestyle for sure.
So it's a really good perspective on time management. But yeah, writing is definitely a tough one to get single focus on, right? Mm. Not be distracted. Cool. So, third thing is anything recently you feel like you've changed your mind on that, you know, for a while you held as a strong belief?
That's a very, very good question. You're stumping me with the questions today.
But normally we send them to you ahead of time.
Have you thought about one thing? Because we were talking about at the start of the show, like how much of the planetary, what's happening is bad, is from travel and from all the communication. Mm. Have you thought more about how much travel is actually necessary now and that, you know, if Zoom gets good enough, even you driving up from Bondi for this podcast is kind of unnecessary, right? If you could just beam into the chair, it's like, what would be the point of any travel?
Yeah, I agree. Reading my mind, Raph. Thanks for that. That was like a nice little soft throw there for me to hit. little lob ball. Yeah, definitely. Like I would routinely go down to Melbourne maybe once every 4 weeks or 6 weeks and probably should still do that because my mum's down there. But but there would be going down for these business style meeting, right? Yeah. And you lose the whole day. Yeah. You jump on a plane. So you're involved in that. You lose the entire day. Your productivity is through the floor. You probably don't train.
Yeah.
And you get there and you do your hour meeting face to face. And look, sometimes that's still going to be important when it's like, maybe a very important meeting or first time meeting someone.
Right.
But I think once you've established these relationships, particularly, jumping on Zoom, I can't believe I didn't do that sooner.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably a lot of it is like it was in some cases the same, if not better, than doing stuff in person.
Yeah.
But we're creatures of habit, right? We're so consistent. So it had to take something this disruptive to stop us from these old ways to try something new. And like some people are like, hey, we're never going back to offices. We're never going back to work. And I don't think it's going to be everyone, but I think it'll be a lot of things. Like I always give people the example. So I was talking with my mom and one of her friends who works way, way up in the banks. And they're really trying to reorganize their finance department because what happened with the banks is they've been spending so much of the last decade or so offshoring a lot of their jobs, to India and to China and other parts of Asia. And what they realized was, hey, we went to a lockdown. All of a sudden, so much of this ecosystem that ran the banks that we relied on just became incapacitated. We couldn't use them. We couldn't contact them. They weren't allowed to work. They don't have laptops. They couldn't go into the office. Yeah. So the banks
work from home in India. That's for sure.
Yeah, so that's a big risk.
Well, some of them, they just used, there was photos of people in India on the bus with their desktops, just carrying them home to get the work done. And they just laugh at it, but it's crazy. And they go, wow, we're actually more vulnerable than what we thought. Mm. But as a result, they've looked at, okay, what are the best companies in the world doing and how are they becoming more efficient at these processes? And they've gone, well, Apple, second biggest company in the world right now, Amazon's number one, right? Their finance department for the entire Apple is 27 people. It's like, that's crazy, right? You're talking about banks that have been trading for hundreds of years, that thousands and thousands, if not tens of thousands of people involved in these operations. And it's like, okay, they would have never cared to look at what Apple's doing because they're so busy doing their thing that's right in front of them day to day, right? Show up, here's a list of things to do, go to this meeting, call this person, get this boss, meet this deadline. They're tied up, but you put a massive pause in it and goes, okay, how can this be better? Because we're really vulnerable here. And so I think it's been a really good way for so many companies to look at how are we going to outsource more of it to just automation? And then also how can we, like a better use of human resources? What's the point of someone just sitting there, just dragging numbers across and tapping buttons and doing formulas that a computer can do for it? Yeah, that person loses their job, but it frees them up to do something that humans are better at, right? That's ultimately better for the planet. Or someone goes into humanitarian work, or someone goes, oh, finally, I can, go do my passion in farming and stuff. But, there's all different conversations. But, yeah.
No, but that's just another prime example of our ability to adapt.
Yes.
When we're faced with challenges, as human species, we are very innovative, we're very creative, and we can adapt, I think.
Definitely.
12 weeks ago when news came out that the gyms were going to close and whatnot, it was, for many people, would have been almost like life ending. But, I think people have been able to adapt to a certain degree. Yeah. Maybe they still want gyms to open, but I think if they look back, they would be like, okay, I feel much more comfortable now than I did when I first heard the gyms were going to close.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
Which is cool because then you get that personal experience of going, you know what, like I can work through things.
Yeah. And they just realized that the gym was probably serving a different purpose than what they thought.
Yeah.
They might have thought, oh, I go to the gym because, I like getting strong with barbells, or like it's really important to me to use kettlebells or whatever, or get coaching or whatever. And they go, okay, well, I can still get a lot of these things from home workouts. Why I like the gym is from the social aspect. It fits nicely into my routine. Like that. Or maybe I'm good friends with the coaches at the gym or the trainers, and they're an important part of my mental health because I get to talk to them and, kind of go back and forth.
Yeah,
that's
true. I think that's something I definitely underappreciated. Mm-hmm. You take for granted the familiar face and the person that you chat to on the way in. Maybe you might only talk to someone for a minute and you move around, you see someone else, and that sense of connection and familiarity is nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I think people were like, okay, cool. My worst fear was I'm going to get fat and out of shape. Mm. It's not that. Like, I didn't. I'm the same. I'm still in shape. It's not the end of the world. I'm still eating well. Maybe I'm training more often, but I still miss the gym. Mm. But it's just for different reasons. Mm. I think that was a good, realization for people, because I think a lot of marketers, especially a lot of these big franchises, they trap people into thinking that like, if you stop doing our workout, you're going to get fat or you're not going to look good or whatever. And then people started to realize, I can stay in shape by myself, you know, or I can stay relatively healthy by myself. But yeah, I need the gym for different reasons.
Which is interesting though, because I think, you know, probably over the last 5 years or so, there's also been that that move from some franchises more towards community building. Where they have, you know, they have started to realize that bonus of creating the community as well.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of gyms that don't have that and probably never will have that, like a Fitness First or an Anytime Fitness or those sort of huge commercial 24-hour gyms, people are just, they're not going to go back to them, you know? And
if you have the equipment at home, it's like, well, now what do you offer besides a queue?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, it's going to be interesting sort of the next 6 months for the fitness world.
Yeah. So last thing. Firstly, tell us about your book and when it's coming out. And then if you do, if you've maybe read a really good book that, that helped you to kind of get the book that you've written, that, you know, people can pick up now.
So firstly, a book to read, Fiber Fueled.
Okay.
Written by a friend of mine. He's a gastroenterologist. I've had him on my show a number of times. He has written a whole book on fiber.
Okay. What's his name? Important.
His name's Dr. Will Bolsiewicz.
Okay. Aussie guy, or?
It's an incredible read. He's very, very intellectual and super across the science. The book is very highly referenced.
Yeah.
But he writes in a way that's very easy to digest.
It's a good combination.
Yeah. So it is. It's an amazing read for anyone out there who wants to understand the power of fiber and to understand the role that the different types of fiber and when for fiber ferments in your large intestine, you get production of short chain fatty acids and why they're beneficial locally in the gut, why they're beneficially more systemically throughout the body. It's a great read. So definitely Fiber Fueled. My book, the writing, it's been an evolution in terms of the process. Essentially the book is written for, anyone who really, my approach was, I just want to separate fact from fiction. I'm not writing for a particular label per se in terms of adopting a particular label. I just want people to understand where the science sits, but, and I separate, the human health from the planetary health. I felt it was important to put planetary health in there because I feel like human health and planetary health are inextricably tied together. We can't be healthy without a healthy planet. And if we're promoting nutrition today, we have to be considering planetary health. Mm. That was the conclusion I came to. So they, but I've separated them. So they're a distinct separate conversation to not blur lines between the science. Mm. So I go through, there's a chapter I call Diet of Confusion, which essentially is a bit of a, an unraveling of why most people would be confused, and why it's fair that most people are confused.
Mm-hmm.
What exists today to confuse people?
Yeah.
So that's that sort of set the scene there, and then jump into the science on human health and planetary health, and the latter part is more helping people make transitions, understanding important nutrients of focus and things like that.
Are you gonna do an audio version as well?
Yeah, I think there will be an audio version.
Your voice or someone else?
I'll probably record it, to be honest. Yeah, yeah, I think if you have a podcast and you have a community, then they expect, if they're going to listen to the audiobook, it's you. Yeah. It may not be for everyone, but I think, I am penciled in to record it. So.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I know when James Smith recorded his book, I don't think it would be the same if he had someone else do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, people wanted to hear it in his voice.
I think that's important.
Man, I wouldn't argue that most authors these days should have it in their voice.
It's changed. All the old audiobooks always like the same guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This dude must have had...
he probably died.
So busy doing everybody's book. And then,
You just lose a little bit of that connection. I think if the author hasn't done a whole lot of talking, it may not be so important.
Yeah.
But if
if you know what they sound like.
If you know what they sound like, then I think it's going to come across a bit more genuine, their tone and whatnot.
Yeah, cool. People can follow you at PlantProof or Plant_Proof.
Plant_Proof.
Yep. Yeah. All your information's on there. Is there anywhere else that I know you'll have the blog? Will that be on the website?
Yeah. So I'll put that blog up. and I'll send you guys a link so you can put it in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes.
So people can quickly flick over to it.
Yeah.
And yeah, if you have questions, then throw them below on any of the creatives that get posted. Yeah. You know, I'm always open to civil discourse and to discussing, you know, if something that I've said, you feel challenged by that, or it doesn't sort of fit with your current opinion, then, you know, I would encourage you to look at the references. And if you want to discuss things further, then, you know, open a conversation with me and we can chat through it. And I'm always happy to look at other opinions and other science, and the end goal being just to improve the knowledge and move closer to where that truth lies.
Absolutely. Simon, pleasure. Guys, thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode with Simon. If you loved it, if you enjoyed it, take a screenshot, tag us both, tag something or write something that you learned that you got a lot out of. And then, of course, if you are interested in joining the Whoop team, go to whoop.com, use the code MMP15, that's one word, and get 15% off your entire cart. Also, head to True Protein to pick up Raph's favorite vegan protein blend. You guys can get that with the code MINDMUSCLE10. That's going to get you 10% off at trueprotein.com.au. Thanks so much, guys, and we'll speak to you next week. Thank you, Project, for tuning in again to another episode of the Mind Muscle Project. We release an episode every single Monday. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, the Mind Muscle Project, to stay up to date with everything we're doing. And if you have some time, leave us a review and a 5-star rating on iTunes.
And don't forget, we have a second show of the week, The After Show. So it's no longer a rest day on Thursdays. If you have any questions for Lachlan and I for that show, head to themindmuscleproject.com/theaftershow. And if you ask a question, we'll answer it on the show.
Thanks again so much, Project, and we'll see you all next week.